peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war. Almost unique, among the major world powers, we have never been at war with each other. And no nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War. At least 20 million lost their lives. Countless millions of homes and families were burned or sacked. A third of the nation's territory, including two-thirds of its industrial base, was turned into a wasteland, a loss equivalent to the destruction of this country east of Chicago. Today, should total war ever break out again, no matter how, our two countries will be the primary target. It is an ironic but accurate fact that the two strongest powers are the two in the most danger of devastation. All we have built, all we have worked for, would be destroyed in the first 24 hours. And even in the Cold War, which brings burdens and dangers to so many countries, including this nation's closest allies, our two countries bear the heaviest burdens. For we are both devoting massive sums of money to weapons that could be better devoted to combat ignorance, poverty, and disease. We are both caught up in a vicious and dangerous cycle, with suspicion on one side breeding suspicion on the other, and new weapons begetting counterweapons. In short, both the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies, have a mutually deep interest in a just and genuine peace and in halting the arms race. Agreements to this end are in the interests of the Soviet Union as well as ours. And even the most hostile nations can be relied upon to accept and keep those treaty obligations, and only those treaty obligations, which are in their own interest. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal. Third, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Cold War, remembering we're not engaged in a debate, seeking to pile up debating points. We are not here distributing blame or pointing the finger of judgment. We must deal with the world as it is, and not as it might have been, had the history of the last 18 years been different. We must therefore persevere in the search for peace, in the hope that constructive changes within the communist bloc might bring within reach solutions which now seem beyond us. We must conduct our affairs in such a way that it becomes in the communist interests to agree on a genuine peace, and above all, while defending our own vital interests, nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or a nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence only of the bankruptcy of our policy, or of a collective death wish for the world.
That was President John F. Kennedy, June 10th, 1963. Just weeks after his speech, Washington and Moscow signed the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Kennedy would be assassinated on November 22nd, 1963, less than 6 months later. Joining us now is Katrina Vandenhoevel, publisher of The Nation magazine, columnist for The Washington Post. Her new piece for Responsible Statecraft headlined, "What Kind of Peace Do We Seek at 60? JFK's Speech Never Gets Old." First, Katrina, congratulations on receiving the Marcus Raskin Award for Civic and Intellectual Courage.
Thank you. Mark was someone who could not condone the madness of the arms race, which he was present at the creation of.
Katrina, I'd like to ask you about this extraordinary speech. Nikita Khrushchev called it the greatest speech by a U.S. president since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And the timeliness of it, given the situation we're facing now. Of course, then the United States was in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, but now it's the Russian Federation, no longer communist, now an openly capitalist. And we still have a similar confrontation.
You know, what interests me, Juan, is when you listen to the speech, first of all, many people in this country would think President John F. Kennedy was a subversive. I'm not sure he'd be permitted on TV or some of our TV. He might be demonized or slurred. Peace has become a subversive word in these last decades, and that is a tragedy. There's reference to 18 years before, as he gives a speech, and that's a reference to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also the charged environment coming off of the Cuban Missile Crisis, where millions of Americans did feel hostage to the nuclear arms race. That has dimmed, in a sense. I mean, Amy, you remember, Juan, perhaps a million people in Central Park in June 1982 fighting for a freeze of the intermediate nuclear range missiles. But with the waning of fear, there's been a normalization in talk about using tactical nuclear weapons. And this is so dangerous. I think what President Kennedy's speech does, and you just did an extraordinary public service, in retrieving American history, there are parts so many don't know, and that speech is vital for a roadmap, a guide, a primer for today, as I write in the Responsible Statecraft piece, the Biden administration could certainly take a page because they are so far away from this thinking in terms of the belief that military might is what is needed to resolve the critical needs of our country and the world at this time.
And could you talk about Norman Cousins, who was an anti-nuclear and peace activist who had enormous influence on this speech? The historians have said that Kennedy did not at all alert either the CIA or the Joint Chiefs of Staff that he was about to make this speech.
Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs, that he couldn't rely on the military. And in that context, he brought together not only Norman Cousins, and that's an interesting side story, because in previous administrations over time, people have been brought in as mediators, not officials, but, for example, in negotiating with Cuba years before. Norman Cousins was a very eminent editor of the Saturday Evening Post, and he also had relations with Kennedy. And Kennedy trusted him to speak to Khrushchev. And I think that kind of negotiation can be valuable when the officials are frozen. Where is John Kerry is in the administration, but where is John Kerry perhaps negotiating, talking behind the scenes? I think we want more transparency in our foreign policy, but at the same time, negotiations often demand a level of behind the scenes.
So, Katrina, we're speaking now as the largest NATO air deployment exercise in its history is going on in Germany with over 10,000 participants, 250 aircraft from 25 nations. Japan and Sweden, not NATO allies, are also participating on this. In this. Can you talk about the significance of this at this time and what you feel needs to happen?
Well, imagine at this juncture where there could be a track toward escalating negotiations, talk. Instead, we have, as you noted, the largest air exercise, NATO air exercise, in history. And I think that is a measure of the mindset that President Kennedy warned of, the militarization of the mindset. Now, I condemn the war, the brutal war. In addition to what we're witnessing with NATO air exercises, Amy, Juan, we are witnessing probably the greatest environmental disaster in the modern history of Ukraine with the breach of the dam. So there are costs that demand attention, and instead we're getting all these military investors continuing to hawk, peddle their wares. And as President Kennedy said, this is not addressing the poverty, the disasters, the pandemics, the climate. This is addressing more and more wealth, money going to the arms race. And that is a tragedy, and one that President Kennedy alludes to in his great speech.
And Katrina, could you talk about how the speech subsequently led to a partial nuclear test ban treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union?
Well, the idea of words leading to deeds was a part of the Cold War history, ironically. What we've witnessed in these last years, decades, is the rollback of the infrastructure of arms control. Now, some people are more abolitionist, but the prudentialists, let's say, are witnessing more and more nuclear stockpiles. I believe nuclear stockpiles, according to a Swedish institute last month, have grown. And what has not grown are the negotiations needed to curb the dangerous, perilous menace. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved its doomsday clock forward to alert people. But we seem to be sleepwalking, or instead of sleepwalking, it's all about the new lists of weapons. So, you know, I don't agree with Ambassador Michael McFaul on much, I'll tell you. But Sam Sharap, in a very good piece in Foreign Affairs, noted that there is like 300 military people in a commission are tasked with military equipment purchases. There's no conflict diplomatic figure tasked at this moment to trying to find a dual-track way to end this war, which is ravaging Ukraine and ravaging Russia. And those who are serving are the poor, the provincial men, their men, and the elites, which is what this dangerous figure, Prigozhin, is trying to make hay out of, are doing pretty well, many of the elites. So this is a very difficult time internally. In addition to what's happening in this country, where the Russophobia is afflicting the mindset of cancel Dostoevsky, cancel Chekhov. I mean, I think this is madness. And President Kennedy's words are those of a sober person, a president. I mean, if he gave that speech on the floor of the Capitol, he'd be run off, which is a measure of what we need to do to return to sanity and restraint and a diplomatic, when war should be the very, very, very last resort, which is not the case.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, we thank you so much for being with us, publisher of The Nation magazine, columnist for The Washington Post. Her new piece for Responsible Statecraft, we'll link to it, What Kind of Peace Do We Seek? At 60, JFK's speech never gets old. Coming up, we speak to the son of an internationally renowned Guatemalan journalist, Jose Rubén Zamora, who's been jailed for nearly a year. This week, he faces up to 40 years in prison at his sentencing. Stay with us.
Don't wash the cast iron skillet. Don't drink and drive, you spill it. Or you'll never get to sleep. There's a hole inside you, fill it. Shower up and shave, put flowers on the grave, and ask the Lord to save his soul, although you know it's too late. Was it 27 times or was it 29? I heard the blade broke off inside the man and he took a while. How did you get so low? Seems like just a week ago we were 10 and 12 years old. He was sweet and soft, shied away from the inside fastballs and died doing life without parole. Don't That dog bites my kid, I'll kill him.
Cast Iron Skillet by Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how the internationally renowned Guatemalan journalist, José Rubén Zamora, faces 40 years in prison at his verdict and sentencing hearing Wednesday in Guatemala City, after he was arrested in what press freedom and human rights groups say are trumped-up money laundering charges. Zamora is the founder and president of the independent investigative Guatemalan newspaper El Periódico, and for decades has reported on government corruption. International rights groups and the Guatemalan Association of Journalists say the case against him is politically motivated. This is José Rubén Zamora speaking after his arrest last July. He's been in prison since.
They chased me and my children in the streets in a very dangerous way. My family had to go into exile. My home was illegally raided, but they haven't gone as far as now with them formally arresting me. I don't know how long the process will take. This is a narco-klepto dictatorship. 4 years ago, our apparent democracy was transformed, electing a president that is a thief who has been assaulting us for the past 4 years. Us, as Guatemalans, we don't have the capacity to defend ourselves.
After Zamora's detention, El Periódico was forced to stop publication of its print edition. The newspaper then shuttered its online version May 15th due to what the paper called judicial and financial harassment from the right-wing government of the Guatemalan president, Alejandro Giammattei. It signed off with a single headline in Spanish that translated to, "We say no to power, 1996 to 2023. It had been publishing for 27 years. Rights groups say Zamora has not received a fair trial under Guatemala's Attorney General Maria Consuelo Porras, who is on a U.S. State Department list of corrupt and undemocratic actors. For more on José Rubén Zamora and the sentencing tomorrow, we're joined in Miami by his son, José Carlos Zamora, who is also a journalist. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, though, under these very difficult circumstances. Tell us what happened to your father and what this sentencing means tomorrow in Guatemala City.
Hi, Amy. Good morning. And good morning, Juan. And thank you for having me and for paying attention to what's happening in Guatemala. Well, what happened is my father has over a 30-year trajectory in doing investigative journalism in Guatemala. At El Periódico with his team, he has been doing it for 26 years, specifically in the government of Alejandro Giammattei. In the first 144 weeks of the administration, he and his team published 144 stories and investigations into corruption in about Giammattei. This led to this political persecution. In Guatemala, there is a democratic facade, but the executive controls the judiciary. And they are using criminal law to persecute anybody who they consider a critical voice. The Giammattei administration has been systematically attacking all democratic institutions and persecuting anybody who had anything to do with fighting corruption, including the highest profile judges, prosecutors, activists, and in the case of my father, journalists. As you were saying, it's incredible that the public ministry requested a 40-year sentence, which is historically there hasn't been such a request for these types of cases. So it's really shameful and ridiculous, and it really shows clearly that it's a political persecution. And when they arrested him and processed him and with this sentence, what they want to send is a very clear message to all journalists in Guatemala that in the country, doing journalism is a crime.
And Jose Carlos, could you talk to, for those who are not familiar with the most recent history in Guatemala after the peace accords, and it looked like Central America was heading in a better direction, and even the perpetrators of some of the genocide were tried. What has happened in recent years that allowed this resurgence of this this right wing government in your country?
Well, we, since 85, we started our new democratic era. We had the opportunity to start with a clean slate, but every 4 years we change government, and every government has been very corrupt. But in the last 10 years, there was a big effort to fight corruption, and it was working. And when they saw these different groups that are involved in corruption saw that it was working, they all became allies, dismantled that effort. And not only they did dismantle it, but they started persecuting anybody who was involved in fighting corruption. And that's exactly what is happening now. And what you see is not only that they are persecuting anybody who was involved in fighting corruption, but now people who were involved in the highest profile corruption cases and also human rights abuses during the war, they are being let free. So you see a regression and a lot of repression. This administration, the Yamatei administration, has not only been corrupt, but extremely repressive. There's never been since 1985, there have never been so many Guatemalans in exile fleeing political persecution, from judges to prosecutors to journalists. The official number is around 40, but it's estimated that it's around 80 people who are left the country because they were being politically persecuted. And the ones that didn't leave are in prison and facing these ridiculous, processes. Like in the case of my father, not only was his case fabricated, but he has been made go through a process that has been a total violation of due process. And now he's facing this, this sentence. We really expect him to be convicted because the system is corrupt. And really what we're seeing is that the government of Alejandro Yamatei has him as a hostage.
If you can talk, Jose Carlos Zamora, about the past threats against your father. There's been assassination threats, death threats, kidnapping threats. But what it means that they bring charges of money laundering against him now. And ultimately, what we're talking about is this coming together of the elite and the governing elite, Yamatei, the Pacto de Corruptos, I think they are referred to in Guatemala.
Yes, correct. It's the use of the law to persecute critical voices and journalists and opposition. It's really damaging to democracy and to the country. And that's what we're seeing. Before, when it came to journalists, and for example, what you were mentioning about my father, throughout his 30-year career, he has been shot at, kidnapped. The entire family has been attacked and kidnapped. He has been, they attempted to assassinate him in 2008. There's been car bombs. Everything you can imagine has happened. But what we see is an evolution in how the government has become more sophisticated in attacking journalists. And this also comes from other repressive regimes. They copy each other, from the Philippines to Venezuela to Nicaragua to Guatemala. Before, they would do two things: attack a journalist's credibility, because they know that's the only asset a journalist has. And from the other side, they would do these death threats and assassination attempts. But then they discover that killing journalists comes at a very high price. So when you control the law and the judiciary, it's much simpler to use the law to persecute anybody who you consider opposition. And that's what they are doing. In case of they started first with civil law, with these slaps lawsuits, but then they saw an even more efficient tool in criminal law, because that allows them to have these trumped up charges on money laundering, and that allows them to have an arrest warrant to arrest a journalist and place him in jail, and it really changes everything, and it allows them to say under this democratic facade that it's not about journalism, that it's not about press freedom, but it's about a criminal. So it's it allows them to continue to attack the credibility of a journalist, but it also allows them to neutralize him if you put them in prison. So it's and it's a very clear message to all other journalists in the country that they can come after anybody who continues to denounce corruption.
And Jose Carlos, how is your father doing in prison? Where's he being held? What are the conditions of his detention? And have you spoken to him recently?
He's in a prison that is a military base. He's healthy. He's in good spirits. But he's been 319 days in prison today, in what pretty much is solitary confinement. So he spends 23 hours a day in solitary in a very small cell that is in very bad shape. So the conditions aren't very good, because the government really had three objectives when they arrested him. One was to punish him directly. He's a pain for them. He has denounced all of their corrupt acts. So they really wanted to punish him directly, and that's why they have him in such bad conditions in this tiny cell. The second was to shut down the newspaper, which they finally managed to do 11 months later. Because they also started harassing and attacking advertisers. And the third point was to send this really clear message to all journalists in the country that in Guatemala, doing journalism is a crime.
Jose Carlos, we just have about a minute, but what can the Biden administration do? I mean, you have these deals being made, especially with Northern Triangle countries, where the U.S. shores them up to stop immigration. Can you talk about that?
I think what there's need to be two things. One is harder sanctions that really have a teeth, right? Like that's one thing. But from the other side, they should stop having these collaborations with them and just with the focus on migration, because it's very nearsighted. Because the true and the root cause of migration is corruption. It's corruption and repression and violence. And that's really what's driving migration. And until that root cause isn't addressed, people won't stop migrating. So you definitely can fund a military police that tries to stop people south of the border. But unless these root causes are addressed, people won't stop coming to the U.S.
Jose Carlos Zamora, we thank you so much for being with us. Guatemalan journalist based in Miami, the son of the internationally renowned Guatemalan journalist Jose Rubén Zamora, who faces 40 years in prison at his sentencing on Wednesday after being jailed for nearly a year on what press freedom and human rights groups say are trumped up money laundering charges as political retaliation over exposés of government corruption in Guatemala. Jose Rubén Zamora is 66 years old, and we'll report on what happens tomorrow in the courtroom in Guatemala City. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Perud, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
pigeon rap,
and anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.